Session number 27083, Reel 49.
Sir Henry, you'd had this South African frigate with you the whole way down from the Azores.
Yes, and she'd gone the whole way up with previously with the second flotilla. But it was sufficiently sensitive that I didn't want to comment on that. And so I merely gave him a beaming smile and said, if you want to ask a question about one of your naval ships, you better talk to your naval NCO.
Yes.
And he gave a broad grin. He was quite a decent chap, actually. It was a trial. We got away with it. But it was a very sensitive issue. And they actually replied to my 21-gun salute with 22 guns. And somebody got hold of that. As I say, this left winger in the house who raised this whole thing, there was quite a furore. And
there was a furore about the Heath government resuscitating the Simonstown Agreement, which they had done only about three years before.
Yeah.
So
and what was the matter with that?
Well.
But so there it was. Yes. Well, then we sailed. And we went round the corner. We had, I suppose, the usual 5 days visit there, sort of thing. We went round the corner. And we were next going into Mombasa, where we were going to have, something like getting on for 3 weeks, because we were going to have a maintenance period for all ships. This being really the last convenient place to do it until we got to Singapore eventually. And a full program had been arranged for calls and the usual sort of things that go on for a visit and so on. And one by one on our way up to Mombasa, one by one these got cancelled. And the Kenyan government, of course, it being October, they were all away on the holes. And so the lesser men, the number twos or the number threes, were in office. And they all had twitch, and every official thing was cancelled, but every, which made an interesting situation, but there it was. On the way up, we passed the Russian squadron, the carrier and a couple of cruisers on the way down. And we would have, for the first and last time in my life, I had to make an adjustment of course, otherwise we would have met head on, and I didn't think it was really very politic to do a gridiron movement with them. And so I gave way. We didn't have to, but it was politic to do so, and that was that. We didn't exchange signals, and we never saw them again. In Mombasa, there was, as I say, no entertainment at all. No calls, no officialdom. I wrote a note to the head of the Kenyan Navy, who was a commander, a Kenyan, and suggested that if I happened to pass his house one evening at about 6:30 in not a passenger car but a taxi, wearing plain clothes, and he happened to be in his garden, and I happened to spot him, and I happened to call out, and he happened to ask me in for a glass of grog, we might meet. But it was too much for him. We never did meet. He couldn't face it. And the thing to do there, in terms of taking rabbits back home, so to speak, the thing to do was to go for sugar. Sugar was dirt cheap, very easy to obtain. And it wasn't all that easy to obtain back in the UK even then. I don't know why, but it wasn't. And the thing to do was to get a great sack of sugar, you know, something like 100 weight at a time, which cost you practically nothing. And some of my staff and I, they rather led me ashore one night, I think, and we went the rounds, we had a good dinner, and we'd stopped to order this particular place where you've got your sugar from, to pick it up on the way back. And I suppose then it must have been close on midnight, and the taxi was already a bit overloaded with us, and these huge sacks of sugar were piled into the boot. You could feel this rather ancient American type soft sprung car sinking onto its wheels and so forth. By the time we got back alongside the ship, of course, it was after midnight. So there was only the officer of the watch and the gangway staff present to receive us. And no way could we hunt this stuff on board. And we had to have a bit of assistance. Needless to say, even at that time of night, this got out and was portrayed in the oily rag as soon as we put to sea a few days later, with suitable cockroach inscriptions and so forth. The High Commissioner was a man called Duff. I don't know whether he's still alive or not. He had some intelligence job in London later on. He was, shall I say, rather sensitive about his position and regarded it as one of not inconsiderable importance. Need I say more to epitomize his general attitude and that? But he laid on his driver and his Range Rover to take myself and another officer, one of my staff, who had a relative living up in Nairobi, and to take us up to the Tsavo Game Park, which was very interesting, and we spent a night at the game lodge, and so on. And when we got up there, I stayed in the High Commissioner's house, and my friend went off to meet his chum. There were no calls, even by him. And it was of interest that something like 2 months later, I got a bill from this chap. His wife was charming, and she had taken me around throughout the whole of one day. And we'd gone and seen the flamingos and Lake Nakuru and so on, and it was delightful. He was very busy doing, as far as I could see, nothing at all, but he was very busy doing it. And I suddenly got a letter from him a couple of months later saying that the bill for staying in the game lodge was whatever it was, and it was about, I forget what it was now, it wasn't excessive, but it was about 50 quid or something. And he'd be glad to receive a cheque for it. Hadn't mentioned this before. And he waffled on, and he wrote, you know, several pages of ridiculous letter, and ended up by saying, so perhaps I could send him a cheque. But of course, if I find this difficult, then be my guest, and ha-ha, sort of thing. This irritated me beyond measure. In the first case, because it had unannounced, it had let my young staff officer in for his share of the bill, if we paid it that way. And secondly, I did not think that it was how a High Commissioner should conduct his affairs. And I debated what to do, and I finally sent him a cheque, that covered both of us, didn't mention this to her. He didn't demand a cheque from a staff officer. And I sent it with the envelope correctly addressed and just the cheque inside the envelope and nothing else, no covering letter at all. And that was that. Very curious. Not a very good representative.
It's curious that a man can reach that rank with such.
And he'd been in the Navy. He'd got a DSC in the Navy during World War II.
Yes.
However, there it is. Now, I'm skipping. We went out to further on. We went to Karachi.
In between times, you would have exercised the whole time.
Oh, exercising that mad the whole time, yes. The whole time.
And
I even had a complaint from the captain there for the frigate squadron that he didn't get enough time on his own and so forth. But I didn't give him very much peace.
Oh, he didn't have enough time with his own squadron?
Yeah.
To work with them alone?
Or with his own ship to do the things that he would like to have done. Because he was always doing something that I told him to do, and so forth. I turned a bit of a blind eye to this. And,
so it was you and your staff who devised what you wanted to do?
Yeah.
What you were going to do?
Yes. And we kept them fairly briskly at it. And so we darkened ship sometimes at night. We zigzagged. We did all sorts of warlike things, and so on. The one thing we were short of course, was practice facilities in terms of targets, either for weaponry or anti-submarine. And we had, there was a dearth of those. We did an exercise with the Pakistan Navy, which was quite short and not really very taxing and so forth. And then we went on further east. And I suppose you must have gone to Singapore, but there's nothing to be said really about that. And we ended up on a visit to Manila. And I called on the president and did all the usual sort of things. And that was fine. And the Americans had set up an interesting arrangement just outside Manila. And it was a drug rehabilitation center. And this was because drugs were absolutely rife there. Probably still are, I think. And it was an American parson, I think he was, missionary perhaps he even called himself, and they built a hut, and they had built a, they had a sort of couple of classroom type thing, in Nissen hut form. And he was quite a young man, in his early 30s, and he determined to work, as it were, top down in his approach. And the worst drug addicts, which were, and they ranged from 12 upwards, they were all quite young, and they were the sons or daughters of really well-to-do local people or business people with pots of money, and they were just bored, and their parents were quite busy and didn't take charge of them. And as he cured, which is almost on an individual basis, and he'd been at it for 18 months or so. It was very impressive. As he cured an individual or two, he sent them back into the outfield to bring in more, to bring in others, and so it was a rolling program. And while we were there, they were going to open and sort of commission a new building as part of this centre, and quite a thing was going to be made of it. I can't remember if the president was going or what. And I had ordered, of course, no passers cars, and they didn't lay anything on. And this was a, what was it called, a civic assistance program by the Americans. And we'd ordered a taxi, and it didn't turn up. And it was going to, we were supposed to get to the ceremony at about 10 o'clock in the forenoon or so. And the cab didn't turn up. And it was very difficult to get hold of a cab. Eventually we did. And it took us in the wrong direction. And I went with a couple of staff, dreadfully hot, full whites, choker neck, all the rest of it. We eventually got there. And it was late. In fact, I think it was sort of half time in their program. And they had a largely musical program. And they started with people who had been almost completely cured of their affliction. And each successive turn were people who had been less completely cured, and so on. And they ended up with a pathetic trio, but all singing something or other. And they were so uncured, they were in chains. And we arrived at a sort of break point in the program. And a dreadful harridan, who I think was an American wave, probably, advanced towards me carrying a lei to put over my head. And I remembered this drill from Pearl Harbor that I described earlier. And so I bowed my head, and she put it over her head.
And over your head?
Over my head, and that was fine. And then I thought, well, I must do the necessary now and give her a smacking kiss on either cheek. Which I wasn't much looking forward to, because they were pretty wrinkled cheeks. And so I leant forward with this in mind. And as I leant forward, she leant back. And we had a sort of swaying situation until somebody had to break the deadlock. And she took a step back and fled. So I never had to plant this kiss on this awful wrinkled cheek. And so on, silly things that come to mind. Then we did a series of exercises with the 7th Fleet, the American 7th Fleet, and that was all good, sharp stuff. And we, it was good to operate with them, and back we came to Manila. And various things went on. I could go on and on.
What were they like in terms of their professional competence? And
oh, they were pretty good. But there were some things they did in a slightly different way, and so it was important to keep in touch with them. No, they were good.
And they felt the same about you, one assumes?
Oh, I think
did
so.
Did you get any feeling
so.
Of that?
The big difference that they ran in their Navy was, and it's still the same, I think, that their squadron commanders, their Captain D, their Captain F, was not captain of his own ship. He was the rider, but he wasn't the driver. And there was no doubt at all that the standard of ship handling, particularly in a close quarter situation, was not excessive. We had the edge on them. And there's something about it being your fault, and this is where the buck stops, that I think is much better. They argued that the senior officer was able to be detached and was able to give better direction to his flock and all that stuff. It's a valid point, but if you're up to it, I think you can do both. Anyway, there it is. That was a major difference. Now, I'm going to switch, because I mentioned earlier that relationships between the RAF and the Navy in the MOD were, frankly, abysmal. The relationships between the Vice Chief of the Naval Staff, Terry Lewin then, who's now my CNC, and the Vice Chief of the Air Staff, who was an extremely nice and straight man called, needless to say, Splinters Smallwood, who I'm afraid is dead now, poor chap, but a super chap, and absolutely dead straight down the line. He was not one of the people responsible for all this heaving and hoeing. They got on very well together. And so, although I was on this group deployment, and being with my flotilla had occupied most of my time in the early months, there was no point in my sort of solemnly following them all the way around the Indian Ocean and so forth, because I had other elements back in home waters. And so I flew back home. And one of the early things I did was to call on Splinter Smallwood, who by then was AOCNC's strike command. And he kindly asked me to lunch, and I put to him the proposition. I sought his authority to make, without reference to him, to make a direct approach to his various group commanders at Air Vice Marshal level, and through them to arrange to visit certain airfields in their group in order to get briefed, spend the night, and fly a full operational sortie in every one of the frontline aircraft. And I told him why. And he gave me that authority. And he let me fly out in his personal Whirlwind, which didn't have automatic stabilization, it was an overrun, with his delightful ADC. And I hadn't realized that this beast didn't have an auto thing. And I wasn't very au fait with that, and so on. And we took off, and I must say, I sort of retched a bit around the sky, but I got away out of it without actually hitting anything, and so forth. And off I went on my rounds. Now, bear in mind that it wasn't what I was hired to do. This wasn't part of my job at all. This was a bonus. And the job was, to do it at all properly, was fairly time fulfilling in any case. So I had to be very careful not to get led away to this. But I started off, and I flew with this, and I flew with that. And some of it was great fun, and some of it was enormously sick-making, etc. But I think, at the risk of boasting, I think they all realized what it was I was trying to do and why. And I never had a problem in the outfield. They were all very, very nice to me. And one of the earlier ones was to go to Lucas, I think it was, to fly a Phantom. And they wouldn't let me do this because they said I had not been through the explosive decompression testing at North Luffenham. But instead, if I cared to stand out in the apron, they would put the aerobatics man through his paces, and I could watch him doing this, which I did. And it was quite impressive. And the final turn he gave was to appear from behind a hangar and at a height of about 50 feet, come creaming down the runway, and then suddenly go straight up. And it was as he went straight up that I realized he'd been doing this upside down. Well, then we repaired to the squadron mess for a cup of tea. And shortly afterwards, the pilot came in, young flight lieutenant, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, and I went up to him And started saying, well, I thank you very much, and that must have been quite a thing. Oh, piece of cake, he said, SOP, wouldn't give an inch. And I thought, well, bloody liar, but he never turned to her, because he'd been busy, of course. But a few moments later, in came his tack-nav, who, in the circumstances, had had nothing to do except sit her. And he tottered to the nearest wall. He was ashen white. He had beads of sweat all over his face. Somebody thrust a cup of tea into his hands, and it all rattled. And he could hardly speak. And then I know, because that was the position that I was going to be in, and I knew what I'd let myself in for. But not yet, because I hadn't been through North Luffenham. And so I said, all right, well, if that's what it takes to fly a Phantom, I will go to North Luffenham, and then I'll fly one. And I was just about due for my annual medical checkup, Pulheim's, at the time. So I made a date to go across to Hasler. And I'd written in advance and said that, as well as my Pulheim's, I wanted a chit to authorize me to go through the explosive decompression thing at North Luffenham. And I was indeed on my way to North Luffenham in a naval aircraft. And the Surgeon Rear Admiral came out to meet me, and I'd known him previously in Malta. Perfectly nice man, but a bit of a stuffy old stick. And the man who did my naval Pulheim's was a personal friend, a chap called Peter Preston, very good doctor, and very helpful. But he was so busy talking about neutral friends, he did my Pulheim's. He completely failed to observe a small hernia that I had, and so on. And then I said, now I want a blood chip for North Luffenham. And he froze, and he said, no, this is not possible. To give you that, I'd have to have you here for at least 2 days and give you ECGs and subject you to this and that and so forth. And I thought, Christ, it's a waste of time going to North Luffenham. And I really hadn't got time to waste. And so, rather than the spur of the moment, I said, all right, write me a brief chit saying, under no circumstances must I do the explosive decompression test. And he looked a bit surprised, but he did it. And off I went. And I went to North Luffenham, and I flew, and I wasn't very good at flying the fixed-wing naval thing, so I gave my flag lieutenant a bit of a heart attack. But we got there, we landed on, I went off to lunch, very jovial lunch with the station commander. They couldn't have been more welcoming or friendly. And then the moment of truth arrived, and I arrived at the reception place for the explosive decompression test. And the chap said, have you got a chit, sir? And I said, yes, and without batting an eyelid, I handed over this negative chit. They never turned to her, and the CO said, well, I tell you what we'll do, sir, we'll take you up to a much lower height, we won't give you an explosive decompression, we'll bring you down again, and we'll show you a film of the real thing, and then we'll give you a clearance jet to fly the Phantom. And I said, thank you very much. And I watched this film. There was the poor chap, you know, with his skin pulled off his cheeks and looking as if he really was exhumed and so forth. But I had my clearance to go. So that was that. Well, one of the next ones I went. Of course, all this was split up, and I did it whenever I could take a day off, as it were. And I went to... I can't remember which air station it was, and it doesn't matter, to fly the Buccaneer. And I didn't want to fly a naval one, though I think Ark Royal was still operating. Pretty sure she was. But that wasn't the point. The object, in fact, was to fly with the RAF. And I went to this air station, and that was fine. I spent the night there, and it was off the East Coast. And in the morning, I got the tactical briefing and so forth. And I was going to go in one Buccaneer, and we were going to follow through another, as it did medium toss bombing on the Tain range off the East Coast. And I said, well, now, should I be going through medium toss bombing as well? And they went into a huddle and they said, well, not really, sir, I don't think, because there's not much point in doing anything like that if we're going to pass out. No, I agreed, there isn't, so we won't. And off we went. Lovely clear day, and I had a charming pilot, and we flew at about 50 feet over the cornfields and out to the East Coast, and we watched this other chap do his medium toss bombing